It is Mother's Day. Let us attend to our connections of nurture. Let us attend to our connections with children, with our elders, and the kind of connections that hold people together, that hold whole cultures together. It is Mother's Day. Let us attend to some of the ways we are nurtured as individuals, as a community, and as a nation. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Celebrate these new lives. May we be stirred to a fresh awareness of the divine promise of childhood. For we are all children of God, sons and daughters of life's longing for itself and the hope of the world. May we so live that our children will be able to acquire our best virtues and to leave behind our worst failings. May we pass on the light of courage and compassion, and may that light burn more brightly in these our children than it has in us. Amen. I was reading the writings of the prophet Ezekiel in the Bible this week. He's a poet. He puts words in God's mouth, which is what poets do. Ezekiel's God says, "A new heart I will give you, and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will take out of your flesh the heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit within you." I read these words of Ezekiel's and I wonder what that would be like. What would it be like to have within me the heart and spirit of God? What would it be like? I explore it in my imagination and I feel the strange sensation of returning to my world with a new heart. I walk along a busy street. The usual crowds are everywhere, and I look at them, to my astonishment, in a strangely different kind of way. They're not just passing by as indifferent background. They're a continual stream of miracles of creation, and that changes so much. I go to the hike and bike trail, and as I ride my bike, I look at trees and birds, at clouds and animals and all of nature with a different kind of vision. It seems somehow more miraculous. At home, at work, I look at people I dislike and see myself reacting differently. The same thing happens with the people to whom I formerly felt neutral. And I realize to my surprise that I am different even with the people I love. I notice that with this new heart, I am strong in situations I formerly avoided. Sometimes my heart dissolves in tenderness. Sometimes it burns with indignation. The loan of this heart of God makes me independent, and it's a little frightening. I don't cease to be attached to many things, but there's no more clinging. Then, to my alarm, this new heart and spirit steer me into situations that get me in trouble. I find myself more interested sometimes in confrontation than in comfort. I say things that antagonize. And I know how the prophets must have felt. Finally, I come back to the presence of God to give him back his heart. It was exciting being fitted with the heart and spirit of God, but I know I'm not ready for it yet. I still need to protect myself a little. But even as I take my own poor heart back, I know that I will be a different person for having felt, if only for a moment, what it meant to have within me a heart, a mind, and a spirit worthy of God. What would it be like to spend a day or a week filled with the heart and the spirit of God? Would it change the way you see yourself, treat others, think of the world or of life? What would it be like for a day, for a week, for as long as you could bear it? I have heard a conservative described as a liberal who's been mugged. I'd heard that years ago, but I got a new understanding of it this week because my bicycle was stolen. It was stolen Tuesday night from my bike rack on the back of the car while I was in a dinner meeting with our church executive committee down in the campus area. And a few months ago, I had a small Sony mini CD recorder and a Nikon camera and a small black leather bag taken from my office. Both times, I felt angry and violated. I did buy a new bike Wednesday, and it's nicer than the old one. And I bought a lock. But it didn't make me feel more conservative. It made me miss even more the liberal humanities education that American students used to receive in school, but don't receive much anymore. It made me miss the teaching of morality and character in public schools, especially because to teach morality in a pluralistic society like ours, it would have to be a very liberal curriculum. I miss that. No, it won't stop theft, but it would help. How do we teach morality in public schools or anywhere else? In our culture, as in almost all cultures, we have relied mostly on women to teach children a moral sensitivity. We may wish things were more equal. There certainly are men who take powerful and equal roles in the moral education of children. But traditionally, teaching character and morality to our kids has been the job assigned to women, both as mothers and as public school teachers. The best way to teach morality seems to be through stories. That's how Aesop's Fables did it 2,600 years ago. And some scholars think that Aesop, who traveled a lot, got his stories during travels to India from an even older Indian collection known as the Panchatantra. They're animal fables that read a lot like Aesop's fables. Now, when I learned that, my mind immediately went off on a tangent, and I wondered how Indian parents teach their children morality and character. So I looked on the web and found, believe it or not, a website on Indian parenting that's called www.indianparenting.com. It was very easy to find. Sure enough, most of the pictures were of women. And almost every link on this site was to a source for classic Indian stories. The Panchatantra, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, the Jataka tales, the 1001 Arabian Nights, and a whole host of collections of Indian and Hindu fairy tales. We teach morality and character development through stories, not through lists of do's and don'ts or commandments. Stories give us situations and characters we identify with and we remember them. It may be hard to remember that steady persistence pays off better in the long run than unsustained spurts of energy. It's even hard to say that. But everybody remembers the story of the tortoise and the hare. That's how we teach it. That's also how we taught morality and character in American public schools back when we did that in a more intentional way. And we did. From 1836 to the 1920s, American children were educated and their character was shaped partly through the famous McGuffey Eclectic Readers. This was a set of 6 books graded for young children through teenagers The books use poems, stories, pictures, and essays to teach the kids spelling, vocabulary, pronunciation, proper word usage, and fairly sophisticated vocabularies and word usage. But always, the eclectic readers were teaching them what we expect from decent people. That's what education meant. The rest of it was just technical education, not the development of character. It's hard to understand just how influential these readers were, since probably no one here has read much of them. I hadn't until this week. But over 122 million sets of these readers were sold. And from looking at some of the old copies, it looks like most of them passed through the hands of half a dozen school children in their lifetimes. In the South, the only book that sold more copies than the McGuffey readers was the Bible. The moral values most stressed by these readers were honesty, industry, courage, kindness, courtesy, and obedience. I had never read any of these until this week while I was working on this sermon, and probably you haven't read many of them either. So I want to tell you stories this morning. I want to share you just six readings from some of the McGuffey readers. Next week, in the second part of this topic, I'll suggest some other kinds of stories that could be used to teach morality today. It wouldn't violate any separation of church and state, neither did the McGuffey readers. The Bible figured very little in the McGuffey readers. And when it did, as you'll hear, it was often treated quite imaginatively. First reading is an adaptation of biblical materials, though with quite a sobering spin. It's not the way you'd expect reflections on the Bible to read. This piece is called Vanity of Life, written by an 18th century German named Johann Gottfried von Herder, who influenced a lot of German and then American theologians later on. Listen to the tone and message of some of this, reading for American school children 100 years ago. Man born of woman is of a few days and full of trouble. He comes forth as a flower and is cut down. He flees also as a shadow and continues not. The tree has hope. If it is cut down, it may become green again. But man dies and his power is gone. He's taken away, and where is he? Till the waters waste from the sea, till the river fails and is dry land, man lies dead in the earth and rises not again. Till the heavens are old, he shall not awake nor be aroused from his sleep. If a man dies, shall he live again? You contend with us till we fall. You change our countenance and send us away. Though our sons may become great and happy, yet we know it not. If they come to shame and to dishonor, we perceive it not. Now that's not happy-faced baby talk, designed only to make children feel special. This is heavy stuff. This is treating children like people who are expected to grow up into serious and aware adults, able to think about life at deep and quite sobering levels. Next is just one paragraph, written to describe the character of the Puritan fathers of New England. And what that really means is that this is used to describe the character our children and our American citizens were expected to develop. One of the most prominent features which distinguished our forefathers was their determined resistance to oppression. They seemed born and brought up for the high and special purpose of showing to the world that the civil and religious rights of man, the rights of self-government, of conscience, and independent thought, are not merely things to be talked of and woven into theories, but to be adopted with the whole strength and ardor of the mind, and felt in the profoundest recesses of the heart, and carried out into the general life and made the foundation of practical usefulness and visible beauty and true nobility. One of the surprises in reading through the McGuffey readers was the number of women authors who were included. And the pieces by women writers weren't put in as tokens. They were put in because they were good. These readings were chosen for quality, not gender. Here's a piece written by Adelaide Ann Proctor, who was writing just before the Civil War. But notice all the things she does in this amazing little piece. Notice how naturally she mixes masculine and feminine genders and how she uses them. And she teaches her readers that now is the time to bring forth our noble and courageous character. One of America's hallmarks has always been that we worship the present and the future more than the past. This is one of the pieces that taught us to do that for over 100 years. Do not crouch today and worship the dead past whose life is fled. Hush your voice in tender reverence. Crowned he lies, but cold and dead. For the present reigns our monarch with an added weight of ours. Honor her, for she is mighty. Honor her, for she is ours. See the shadows of his heroes girt round her cloudy throne? Every day the ranks are strengthened by great hearts to him unknown. Noble things the great past promised, holy dreams both strange and new, but the present shall fulfill them. What he promised, she shall do. She inherits all his treasures. She is heir to all his fame, and the light that lightens round her is the luster of his name. She is wise with all his wisdom. Living on his grave she stands. On her brow she bears his laurels and his harvest in her hands. Coward, can she reign and conquer if we thus her glory dim? Let us fight for her as nobly as our fathers fought for him. God, who crowns the dying ages, bids her rule and us obey, bids us cast our lives before her, bids us serve the great today. To me, these readings are just arresting. They have a different feel. They're trying to shape children into a different kind of adults than I think we're trying to do today. Fourth, the McGuffey readers were known for their opposition to war. It's a theme you find throughout all six books. But before reading you one paragraph from the McGuffey readers on war, this is a good day to read you something else. Andrea Lerner, our director of religious education, gave me a copy before the first service of the original Mother's Day proclamation written by Julia Ward Howe, who was a Unitarian woman, written in 1872. So before we read what McGuffey has to say about war, let's hear what the first Mother's Day proclamation had to say. It may surprise you. Arise, then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts, whether your baptism be that of water or of fears. Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own, and it says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, Let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of council. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them then solemnly take counsel with each other as the means whereby the great human family can live in peace. And each bearing after her own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. It's not bad. Here's the paragraph from the McGuffey Reader. It's played in the same key. War is the work, the element, or rather the sport and triumph of death, who here glories not only in the extent of his conquests, but in the richness of his spoil. In the other methods of death's attack, in the other forms which death assumes, the feeble and the aged, who at best can live but a short time, are usually the victims. But here, in war, the victims are the vigorous and the young and the strong. It is remarked by the most ancient of poets that in peace, children bury their parents. In war, parents bury their children. This is public school education in the United States. Fifth, there was a story. There were many stories in the McGuffey Readers. It was a story of a young boy who had been given a silver dollar for a New Year's gift. This was before the time of Christmas presents. Merchants only really instituted the habit of giving Christmas presents about 100 years ago. Earlier in the 19th century, there weren't Christmas presents, but there were often New Year's gifts. So this boy was given a shiny silver dollar, which went quite a ways in those days. And he was out walking around, all delighted with his gift, wondering how he was going to spend it, what he was going to buy with this new dollar. While he was doing this, he got involved in a snowball fight with some of his friends. And in the snowball fight, he threw a snowball that broke a window in a stranger's house. Naturally, he and all the boys ran. But after he'd run and hidden, he realized that he couldn't do that, because decent people don't live that way. He learned it in school. So he went up to the door of the stranger's house and told the man that he'd broken his window, and he gave him his silver dollar to replace it. Then he went home, and as he walked home, he realized that he wasn't feeling bad, he was feeling good. He had been hearing for years in school how decent people behaved, and he'd finally realized that today he was one of them. After dinner, his father asked him what he'd bought with his new dollar, and he told his father the whole story. "Ah," said the father, "ah, well, then you better go look in my hat." The boy looked in his father's hat, and there were two silver dollars there. The man who owned the house in which he'd broken the window had sought out his father to tell him what a fine son he had returned the silver dollar, and had added another one to it for his good character. That's public school education. And finally, a poem from the very first McGuffey Reader, 1836, written for young children. The first four lines are still famous. You all know them. But I'd never heard the rest of it. I didn't know it was a longer poem. And I didn't know the point that it was making for young children. The poem is called Mary's Lamb. This lesson, number 44, lesson 44 in the first McGuffey Reader teaches 32 new words, their spelling, their use, and their pronunciation. But listen to what else this poem is teaching. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. He went with her to school one day. That was against the rule. It made the children laugh and play to see a lamb at school. So the teacher turned him out, but still he lingered near and waited patiently about till Mary did appear. And then he ran to her and laid his head upon her arm, as if he said, "I'm not afraid, you'll keep me from all harm." "What makes the lamb love Mary so?" the eager children cry. "Oh, Mary loves the lamb, you know," their teacher did reply. "And you, each gentle animal to you for life may bind, and make them follow at your call if you are always kind." That's how morality and character were taught in American public schools for almost a century. They were taught to the parents, the grandparents, the great-grandparents of almost everyone here. Next week, I'll tell you some stories I think we could use today to teach morality and character in our schools, considering the new fact of the 21st century that now we have many religions and many structures of truth and allegiance rather than just the one that was common in the 19th century. But do you see what we're trying to do with all this and what they were trying to do in the McGuffey readers? We are looking for the words and the ways to fulfill old Ezekiel's poetic dream of so long ago. We are seeking to remove hearts of stone, replace them with hearts of flesh, and fill ourselves and our children with the legitimate heir to what was once called the Spirit of God. What would it be like? What might we, our children, and our country be like if such a miraculous transformation could really happen? It's worth pondering for at least a week.